Thank you for that very gracious introduction, and thank you for your warm welcome, and thank you to all of the co-sponsors of this event, and to all the individuals who have made it happen. And an event like this always involves a lot of work, from booking a room, which of course could be canceled at any moment. It involves designing and distributing a poster, advertising. It involves fundraising. It involves doing media work. It involves picking me up from the airport and driving me around and looking after me all day. And those are all things that take time. And I'm very grateful to everybody who's contributed that I know about and that I don't know about, because I know that other people would have worked on this event that I'm not aware of. This is my second day back in Canada. I came from Regina yesterday, where they had their first ever Israeli Apartheid Week up in the frozen expanse of Saskatchewan. And that's something I think Canada can be very proud of, that Israeli Apartheid Week started in Canada, in Toronto, 7 years ago, and has now spread not just across Canada, but around the world. And there's something like 70 or 80 cities that are holding Israeli Apartheid Week events, including this year in Amman, Jordan. I think it's the first time. And so here you have an idea. We see the flow of ideas goes in both directions. In Wisconsin, people are inspired by the revolution in Egypt. And in Amman, Jordan, people are inspired by the creativity of activists and solidarity work in Toronto. So we really live in a world where our struggles are transnational. And of course, Israeli Apartheid Week has attracted the attention of some of your Canadian politicians. And I think this is worth mentioning. Michael Ignatieff, the leader of the Liberal Party, the leader of the opposition, and would-be Prime Minister of Canada, issued a scandalous statement about Israeli Apartheid Week. I don't know if I'm violating any Canadian laws by criticizing. In many Arab countries, they have laws that it's illegal to criticize the president or to harm national unity, or, you know, by making comments. Tunisia, by the way, is now the freest country in the world. They just abolished their state security police. So congratulations. Look forward to the day when the United States will abolish its state security police, and Canada as well. But Michael Ignatieff, Israeli Apartheid Week is an attack on the mutual respect that holds our society together. It is a dangerous cocktail of ignorance and intolerance, both of which stand in the way of peace. The Liberal Party of Canada condemns Israeli Apartheid Week in no uncertain terms. I would like to rephrase that statement. The Liberal Party of Canada condemns Israeli apartheid in no uncertain terms. If you just take out weak, it becomes a really good statement. But he goes on. He says, and this is very serious, really, very serious. He says, Israeli Apartheid Week does the... There's some boilerplate about peace and all of this. And then he says, Israeli Apartheid Week does the opposite by portraying the Jewish state as criminal, by demonizing Israel and its supporters, and by targeting Jewish and Israeli students for abuse on our university campuses. The organizers and supporters of Israeli Apartheid Week tarnish our freedom of speech. Mr. Ignatieff continues, the voices of anti-Semitism and intolerance have no place in Canada, in the Middle East, or anywhere else in the world. And he goes on and says, I urge all Canadians to join with us once again in condemning Israeli Apartheid Week here in Canada and around the world. Now, and there's so much to say about Michael Ignatieff. One thing is, I think people should investigate whether these statements are actually libelous. Although they don't name individuals, he accuses organizers of Israeli Apartheid Week of targeting Jewish students for abuse and intimidation. A very serious charge, which is really libelous in my view. And he also accuses them implicitly, accuses all of us implicitly, of anti-Semitism. I think this is scandalous behavior for someone who wants to be prime minister of this country or any country. Of course, Michael Ignatieff is also a hypocrite. He wrote in 2002 himself, in The Guardian, April 19th, 2002, he took one of these helicopter tours which the Israelis provide visiting politicians. And he says, when I look down at the West Bank, at the settlements, like Crusader forts occupying the high ground at the Israeli security cordon along the Jordan River, closing off the Palestinian lands from Jordan, I knew I was not looking down at a state or the beginnings of one, but at a Bantustan, one of those pseudo-states created in the dying years of apartheid to keep the African population under control. Those are the words of Michael Ignatieff in 2002. And now he's turning around and accusing us of intolerance and anti-Semitism and intimidation and targeting Jewish students for abuse for talking about exactly the same things that he talked about himself. Now, I would like to go on and on condemning Michael Ignatieff, but I'm going to refrain from doing that. And by the way, any other politician whose statement you bring me, I don't want to make this seem as if there's any party political interest here. I have none whatsoever. But someone brought to my attention today a statement that was posted on rabble.ca called A Response to Michael Ignatieff on His Statement About Israeli Apartheid Week. And it is signed by Nick Day, the rector of Queen's University at Kingston. Now, I'm taking this from rabble.ca, so I'm assuming they have checked the authenticity of it, but assuming the rector wrote it, well, whoever wrote it, it's an incredibly good and courageous statement. And I won't read the whole thing, it's quite long, but he goes through Michael Ignatieff's points, refuting them, and one thing which I think is important to read out. He says, Israel is committing criminal acts according to the International Court of Justice, the General Assembly of the United Nations, and most recently 14 out of 15 Security Council members who voted that the settlements in the occupied territories are illegal. Israel targets civilians in military engagements, imposes collective punishments on the entire Palestinian population, builds civilian settlements on occupied land, operates a discriminatory judicial system in Palestine and has constructed a separation barrier, establishing a structured apartheid in the West Bank. How does it tarnish freedom of speech to foster open dialogue on these criminal acts, bringing these violations of human rights and international law into the realm of public debate? In your view, drawing attention to the criminal acts of Israel is intolerant and tarnishes freedom of speech. But please tell me, what if the state of Israel does commit these crimes? How can we fight to stop injustices if it is automatically anti-Semitic to talk about them? And I think those are exactly the questions that Israeli Apartheid Week poses and challenges all of us to ask. And not only does it ask us to think and speak about these things, but the theme of Israeli Apartheid Week this year is bringing BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to campuses. So it is action. It is collective action to end the kinds of abuses that exist. In my mind, of course, let me step back for a moment. It would be possible to speak for several hours about the nature of Israeli apartheid in all its manifestations. And I don't want to do that. I want to mention just a few points that I think are relevant, and then talk about what we can do, how we can do it, and how we can bring this to an end. Gosh, it's awfully hot in here. Am I the only one? So I don't know if there's any way to adjust the temperature. Otherwise, I'm going to take off another layer, and pretty soon I'm going to be shirtless. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. It's just very, very hot. The trend, of course, for Palestinians, we're soon coming up in the month of May every year, Palestinians commemorate the Nakba. Nakba is an Arabic word meaning catastrophe, but in the specific context of Palestine, it commemorates the 1947-48 ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the systematic removal of the indigenous population in order to make way for the so-called Jewish state of Israel. There have been one of the main narrative strategies of Israel and the Zionist movement has been to attempt to cover up this crime through a number of means. For many years, straight out denial, simply denying that it ever happened. The State of Israel itself engaged in a systematic process of trying to remove the place names even of the 500 Palestinian cities, towns, and villages that were ethnically cleansed in 1947-48. Systematic program also of planting pine forests over the ruins of Palestinian villages. Recently, of course, a few months ago, there was this big Carmel fire, the forest fire near Haifa in Israel. This was one of those forests that was planted to cover up the traces of the several Palestinian villages that that originally existed there before Israel. And the pine forests, of course, they wanted to make Palestine, where the pine trees are not really native, but they wanted the Zionists wanted to make Palestine look a lot more like Germany or Poland. So they planted pine forests everywhere, which burn very easily. But this connects also, again, back to Canada. One of these forests is named after Canada because so much fundraising by the Jewish National Fund that plants these forests is done in Canada and done in the United States with a charitable tax exemption. So charitable funds go from Canada, or funds intended for charity, have helped to cover up this crime. Now, the attempt to cover up a crime is an implicit, in my view, an implicit admission that if it is true that we committed this crime, then we have done a very bad thing. And the narrative strategy of denial has begun to break down as the walls excluding Palestinians from narrating their own history and their own story have been breached, and Palestinians have told their own stories, and historians who've delved into it have corroborated the experience, the lived experience of Palestinians. I know that you've had Ilan Pappé speaking here before, and hopefully he'll come again, but his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, is an example of that. This crime continues to this day where we see, for example, since last May, the Bedouin village of Al-Araqib in the Natab, in the southern area of what is now called Israel, has been bulldozed 18 times by the Israelis. Now remember, these Bedouin inside pre-1967 Israel, so ostensibly they are Israeli citizens. But because they're not Jewish, their homes are simply bulldozed time and again. But their strategy of resistance, the one that the villagers decided on, was to rebuild as soon as their homes are demolished. And they've now rebuilt their dwellings 18 times since May. In Jerusalem, we continue to see the systematic ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem in neighborhoods like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and At-Tur and others, where there is a house-by-house plan to expel Palestinians from their neighborhoods and to put in Jewish settlers. You know, I should draw a map for those who are unfamiliar. Very simple map of historic Palestine. You'll be familiar with the outlines of the West Bank and Gaza. And in 1948, Israel was established on this area. In this area, there are still more than 1 million Palestinians living, the descendants and survivors of the ethnic cleansing of 1948. And then, of course, you have Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Together now, in the whole territory, Palestinians are just over 5 million people, equal in number to the Israeli Jewish population. It's about 50-50 throughout the whole country. So you really do have a situation of apartheid in this sense, where you have one population that lives with a great deal of power and privilege, and another that is completely disenfranchised. But focusing for a moment on Palestinians within Israel, again, they're ostensibly citizens of the State of Israel. They have Israeli passports, and they can vote in elections. But that's where their admission to the state pretty much ends, because we see them facing increasing systematic incitement and racist laws designed to target them and eventually to remove them from the country. A couple of examples of that are the recent statement signed by about 300 Israeli municipal rabbis. These are employees of the State of Israel. Their salaries are paid by the state. And a few months ago, 300 municipal rabbis signed a declaration calling for boycott of any Jew who rents or sells a home to a Palestinian or to a non-Jew. These are state employees. And what was remarkable was how little outcry there was from Israeli politicians. This kind of racism has become quite mainstream. And the reason it's happening now is not a coincidence. It's happening now because the population balance is shifting back towards the Palestinians. Palestinians are once again becoming the majority in historic Palestine, as they were prior to 1948. And what we see as the Palestinian majority reemerges is more and more apartheid-like laws designed to restrict and control and eventually remove the Palestinian population wherever possible. So why has it become necessary in the eyes of state rabbis to ban Palestinians from renting or selling homes in Jewish areas? Well, the reason is very simple. In 1948, 90% of the Palestinians in what became Israel were expelled or fled from their homes and then not allowed to return. The number remaining at that time was about 150,000. In the past 63 years, The number has grown to over 1 million, to about 1.4 million. So almost tenfold. The number of new towns that Israel has allowed Palestinian communities within Israel to build in those 63 years is precisely zero. In that same period, more than 1,000 new settlements and towns have been built throughout the country for Jews. So, as Palestinian citizens of Israel find nowhere to live in their own communities, they must go and look for housing where the housing exists, which is in Jewish communities. And there we see the backlash. One story that really particularly moved me was from last November. This is from Haaretz on November 3rd, 2010. Safed is a town roughly here in the north of what is now called Israel. It says, Safed was plastered with posters on Tuesday denouncing a longtime resident for renting an apartment to three Bedouin studying at the local college. The apartment owner, Eli Tzvavieli, had decided to go through with the rental despite threats that his home would be torched. The posters are the latest episode in an ongoing campaign waged by certain Safed residents led by Chief Municipal Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu to halt the influx of Arab students attracted by the college. How many colleges or universities has Israel allowed to be built by its Palestinian citizens since 1948? Remember, Arabic language colleges or universities. Arabic is one of the official languages of Israel. Israel has two official languages, like Canada does. How many colleges or universities? Zero. So these students, as people have to look for homes in Jewish areas, they also have to go where the colleges and universities are, which is in Jewish areas. So residents who oppose this campaign believe that in light of a recent incident in which three Arab students were brutally attacked, the posters could incite an attack on the 89-year-old Tzvavieli, who is named explicitly on the signs. I mean, this reminds you of something from the Jim Crow South in the United States. The evening before the posters appeared, Tzvavieli, who emigrated to Israel after World War II, I think I read in another newspaper, in The Independent, that he's a Holocaust survivor, and has lived in Safed since 1950, received an anonymous phone call from someone threatening to burn down his home. I'm scared, he told Haaretz, but I have an obligation toward these lovely students. They're in school every day and needed a place to sleep at night. He said that prior to the threatening call, several people whom he did know showed up at his home and asked him not to rent to Arabs. And then it points out that the background, Shmuel Eliyahu, the municipal rabbi, and 17 other rabbis issued a public call to residents not to sell or rent apartments to non-Jews. And it goes on. But if you look in the Israeli press, you find that these kinds of incidents are far from exceptional. They're increasingly common, very common indeed. But this story tells you a couple of things. One is the atmosphere in Israel, the growing incitement and racism against Palestinians, but also that there are people within the Israeli Jewish community who are willing to resist it. They're few in number, but their voices are important, and we should recognize that. Let me talk about what our goal, I think, must be. We have gotten used in the past few years to thinking about a solution an end to the conflict in Palestine, the liberation of Palestine, an end to apartheid as a very distant prospect, something that may happen in our lifetimes or may not. We have to change the way we think. We have to think about the end of apartheid in Palestine as something that is within our reach and within the next few years. And we have to set that as a goal. And I believe that we can do it. And the growth of the solidarity movement over the past few years is an indication to me that we can do it. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is the theme for Israeli Apartheid Week this year, is the technology. I think of it as a technology to move from apartheid to equality, from gross injustice to justice, from a racialized, politicized, religiousified, I don't know if that's a word, state to a state of all its citizens, where every human being has the same rights. It's a technology to help us do that. It's not an end in itself. Don't think of boycotting Israel or divesting from Israel or imposing sanctions on Israel as ends in themselves. They are a means to a goal. Now, for those who don't know the background here, in 2005, Palestinian civil society, hundreds of organizations within Palestine and in the Palestinian refugee and diaspora communities issued a call to the world called the Palestinian Civil Society Call for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And what it says very simply is we call on people of conscience around the world to impose broad-based boycotts, divestment initiatives, and sanctions on Israel until such time as Israel complies with international law and meets three conditions. One is to end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and other Arab lands, including southwest Syria, the Golan Heights, occupied by Israel since 1967. Two, to end all forms of legal and de facto discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel and guarantee their full equal rights. And three, to respect, promote, and implement the rights of Palestinian refugees who currently are not allowed to return to their lands and homes for one reason and one reason alone, which is that they're not Jews. Nobody in this room, I think, would argue that if Israel placed a different arbitrary restriction on the return of refugees, for example, you can't come back because you have the wrong skin color, I don't think anyone would say that's not apartheid. People might say, but this is different. Well, I would argue it's not really different, because Israel's definition of what it means to be a Jew is only one definition of what it means to be a Jew. And it's not a definition based on conscience and choice and saying, I profess to the tenets of a certain faith, although that still wouldn't make it okay. But it is basically a racial or ethnic distinction where you have to prove lineage. It's a genetic distinction. And it's arbitrary. You don't have the choice. Palestinians in Gaza can't say that, we want to be Jews, therefore let us return. But if Israel viewed them as Jews, they would be allowed out of the giant prison camp that is called Gaza, invited back to their lands, which are now largely empty, given all sorts of state assistance, and be allowed to get on with their lives. Those are the three goals of the BDS movement. End the occupation in 1967, end all forms of discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel, and end the racist exclusion of Palestinian refugees. I would like to ask Michael Ignatieff, What about those goals is intolerant? What about them is anti-Semitic? What about them harms the legitimate rights of a single Israeli or Jew? If you think about that, you see the answer is nothing. These are goals based and rooted firmly in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Palestinians living as equals, enjoying their full rights, doesn't threaten anybody. The only thing it threatens is the racial and settler privileges of Israelis. That's what it threatens. And that rightly should be done away with. Israelis, like anyone else, like any other humans, have a right to live in safety and security, but they don't have a right to lord it over other people, especially not indigenous people living on their own land. Let's talk about BDS as a tactic and compare it with some of the Israeli tactics. We are told that boycott, divestment, and sanctions is a very intolerant thing. Academic boycott, for example. Shouldn't academia be sacred? Free exchange of ideas. Isn't it the most intolerant thing you could do to boycott a university? Well, of course, some of the initiatives that will be talked about during Israeli Apartheid Week deal with specific connections between Canadian universities and Israeli universities that are very complicit in the system of apartheid and inequality that I have described. Israeli universities do a great deal of research and development and recruiting for the Israeli military and intelligence services, for example. Tel Aviv University, often portrayed as being one of Israel's liberal universities, is built on the land of several Palestinian villages that were ethnically cleansed in 1948, Sheikh Mouannis being one of them. And there's no acknowledgement of that if you go to Tel Aviv University. There's not even a marker to say that, if you go to some of the national parks in Canada, you see a monument that says, well, this is where native people used to fish before we got rid of them. That's kind of a bittersweet acknowledgement given the continuing discrimination against native people in Canada. But at least there's an acknowledgement. You won't find that at Tel Aviv University. But let's think about the first question I ask somebody who says to me, but, academic boycott is wrong. I say, fine, but what's your position on the Israeli boycott of Palestinian universities? I think that's the first question we need to ask them. Why is it that Palestinian students in Gaza cannot travel out of Gaza in order, many of them, many brilliant students who have won scholarships at universities around the world, who have been denied for years the ability to leave Gaza to take up their positions. Why has Israel imposed that boycott on them? Why can't researchers and academics from the West Bank travel freely out of the country to attend conferences? They can't get permits to go to what's now called Ben Gurion Airport, Lid Airport, to travel out of the country or to go across to Jordan and leave from there. What about that academic boycott? What about the siege of Gaza that has lasted for so many years, that has included paper and ink needed to print textbooks so that children can learn? How about that for an academic boycott? What about the fact that of the 640 schools, primary and secondary schools in the Gaza Strip, during Israel's Operation Cast Lead, its bombardment of Gaza in 2008, 18 schools were completely destroyed. 8 of them kindergartens. And more than 240 were damaged. Half the schools in Gaza were damaged and destroyed. The laboratories of the Islamic University of Gaza, a university where 60% of the students are women, were bombed by Israel. A few days ago, and this was not in the national news in Canada or the United States, the Israeli F-16s went back just 3 days ago and flattened another bunch of buildings at the Islamic University in Gaza. So I have no patience for people who talk about how wrong it is to boycott Israeli universities while maintaining silence about Israel's not just boycott of Palestinian education from kindergarten all the way through university, but bombing of schools and universities. And not only was Israel content to bomb the schools in Gaza, but since that time, it has not allowed any reconstruction supplies into Gaza to rebuild these schools. It's time for Israel to end its boycott of Palestinian academia. And if Israel refuses to do that, and if the Canadian government and the United States and the European Union and the United Nations and all the rest refuse to implement international law in the case of Israel, then it's a duty on civil society to respond to the Palestinian appeal and to act, especially when our countries, the United States and Canada, have been so complicit in these abuses. We call for divestment. For example, for endowments of universities and pension funds to pull out of Israeli companies, especially the companies that manufacture the weapons that have been used to commit human rights abuses and atrocities. What about Israel's campaign of divestment? What about the fact that for decades the Palestinian economy has been suffocated by Israel's restrictions on Palestinian economic activity? The fact that 90% of factories in Gaza and workshops have shut down for the past few years because of the lack of raw materials, the inability to import and export from Gaza. How about that for divestment and economic sanctions? Nobody has talked about imposing sanctions on Israel that would cause Israeli children to go to bed hungry or to see malnutrition rates rise. As Israel's boycott and sanctions on Palestinians in Gaza has caused in Gaza. So let's maintain a sense of proportion. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions we talk about is, yes, intended to impose a price on Israel, but to do so ethically and morally and justifiably, to bring pressure on Israel to change. And this is a perfectly legitimate technology. I think that these strategies have every chance of success, and success in the next few years. I don't want to say 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. I just know it's not 20 or 50 years. I can feel that the change is coming faster than that. If we step up and mobilize more people and get our friends and our families and our colleagues involved in this. The reason I think we will succeed is that a number of critical factors, we're at a number of critical turning points. I already mentioned one, demographic. By itself, it's not decisive. As we saw in apartheid South Africa, a minority can rule over a majority for a quite long period of time through oppression and force. But it's a system that has no legitimacy. And the moment we get, and that moment may have already come, a Jewish minority ruling over a disenfranchised, dispossessed Palestinian majority, there is a real problem of legitimacy. That's one. Another one is, I think, that Israel has reached an ideological dead end in the type of stories it can tell to cover up the crime of apartheid that exists and to forestall and delay the kind of pressure that can bring about a change. I'll give you an example. For the past 20 years, we've had something called the peace process. Without going into a lot of detail about this, I will assert my view, and you can challenge me on it later, that the peace process has been nothing more than a cover for continued Israeli colonization and ethnic cleansing. And the results on the ground are visible to anyone who looks closely. But there's another important role the peace process has played. It has been an alibi and an excuse for complicity and inaction. All of our leaders and governments and politicians, when we would confront them with the facts about what was going on the ground, they would rub their hands and say, oh, well, this is terribly sad, but, you know, there's a peace process, and we support the peace process, and we don't want to say or do anything that could derail the peace process. So it became an alibi for inaction, something for the gutless to hold on to. Take the example of the Goldstone Report, commissioned by the United Nations Human Rights Council just after Israel's massacre in Gaza, conducted by a panel of impeccable credentials, including Judge Richard Goldstone, an international jurist, South African, the former head of the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the former judge of the South African High Court, and himself a Jew described by his own daughter as a Zionist. This report, you can find it online, documents what they call, what the writers of the report call, war crimes and crimes against humanity, and calls for the perpetrators to be investigated and brought to justice. Well, we've seen a number of governments, including Canada and the United States, acting, and these are all governments that profess to hold international law as one of the highest ideals, particularly Canada. I think it's a constitutional duty in Canada for the government to uphold international law. That's not the case in the United States. But they have all worked to forestall and to prevent justice coming, to prevent any action on the Goldstone Report. And the excuse has consistently been, well, we don't want to do anything that could upset the peace process at this delicate time. Meanwhile, Israel understands this as an invitation to continue with all the practices we've been talking about. But I would argue that this cover, the peace process, is blown now. It's finished. Nobody believes it anymore. Nobody buys the story that George Mitchell is going to come over and get Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas together, and they're going to come up with a deal by September, and then everyone is going to live happily ever after. Nobody on earth seriously believes that, not even the people who keep saying it. It's an utter hoax, and it's reached a dead end. What is being exposed more and more is the naked reality of colonialism, apartheid, and racism. I hope that Israel keeps Avigdor Lieberman as its foreign minister for a good long time to come. Because Lieberman is not a new face of Israel. He is the face of Israel that Palestinians have seen since 1948. He is the true face of Israel. And the difference now is that the mask has come off. When Avigdor Lieberman speaks, he speaks for a large section of Israeli society. After all, we keep being reminded that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel has no story to tell other than to deny and to attack, to slander the critics, to call them anti-Semites, even to kill them, as it did with the activists on the Mavi Marmara who were part of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla last May 31st. To tell fabulous stories that a ship, an unarmed international convoy carrying activists, peace activists, and humanitarian aid to Gaza to break a blockade which the International Committee of the Red Cross has declared to be a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention were the aggressors. And that heavily armed commandos who attacked them under the cover of darkness in international waters while the ships were actually sailing away from the coast of Israel, that they were the victims. That sums up, in a sense, the story Israel has been telling since 1948. But more and more people are seeing through it. A very interesting result, interesting statistic. The BBC World Service does an annual poll of global attitudes. They poll 28,619 people in 27 countries. And they published the results of their 2011 survey just 2 days ago. And they found that along with Iran, North Korea, and Pakistan, Israel is one of the foremost negatively viewed countries in the world. But here's the interesting thing. They say, while overall views of Israel have not moved substantially over the past year, there have been significant increases in negative views of the country among Americans, from 31% to 41%, and among Britons, from 50% to 66%. Now, they didn't say anything about Canada, but I would be very surprised if you didn't have a similar result in Canada. And the story that Israel would like us to believe is that this is because all these people are anti-Semites, that they all mean Israel terrible harm, that they've all got the facts wrong, that the dozens of human rights organizations, Israeli, Palestinian, and international, that have documented these abuses year after year are all making it up. But one Israeli diplomat, I think perhaps he was inspired perhaps by some of his Libyan counterparts who resigned from the Gaddafi regime and joined the opposition. A veteran Israeli diplomat, Ilan Baruch, quit a few days ago, saying that he could that Israel's foreign policy is wrong. He says, "I can no longer honestly represent this government." I'm quoting from his statement, as quoted in the on the Israeli news website Ynet of Yediot Ahronot. And he says specifically, identifying the objection expressed by global public opinion to the occupation policy as anti-Semitic is simplistic, provincial, and artificial. Experience shows that this global trend won't change until we normalize our relations with the Palestinians. So there, from an Israeli diplomat, you see a counter-argument to this constant refrain, now picked up by Michael Ignatieff, that us, by sitting in this room to talk about justice and human rights for all who live in this land, are somehow being intolerant and anti-Semitic. We have refutation from Israel itself. I just want to spend a few minutes before closing and going to the Q&A on the broader context. We live in incredible times where we've seen in 2011 already more change than we've seen in many years. The amazing revolution in Tunisia, followed by Egypt, now followed by the revolt in Libya, and by mass movements forming all over the Arab world. I was in Jordan in January and February, and it was incredible to be in an Arab country at that time, as people felt this incredible excitement and energy as they looked around them. And these changes are important for a number of reasons. One, they show us that great historic change can happen, and that it can happen suddenly. That people are still powerful. That when people decide they've had enough, no one can prevent them. These security apparatuses, these police states, built for decades with the full support of the United States, they crumbled in weeks against the sustained challenge of the people they had been built to repress and to control. We're going to see a regional shift in the balance of power. Egypt, which was taken out of the equation by the alliance it had formed with Israel and the United States after the Camp David peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, will find its independent voice again. This will take some time, but it's going to happen. I think these revolutions are profound. That some people had feared that they could just be superficial, that the leader at the top goes, but the regime remains behind. The people of Tunisia have shown that that will not be the case, that the people won't be allow that to be the case, that the removal of the dictator was only the beginning. They got rid of Ben Ali, he fled. Then they got rid of the government that had remained behind, the government he appointed. Just 2 days ago, as I mentioned, Tunisia abolished its state security directorate. And we see Egypt following the same path now, exactly the same path. People will not rest. They won't go back. They won't go back. And these changes are profound. Even if we don't see revolutions in the other Arab countries, change will come. The only question is how. Smaller countries that were dependent on Egypt to provide cover for their own alignments with Israel and the United States will now also have to shift their position. We see in the region the end of an era, two eras, I think. One is the crumbling of U.S. imperial hegemony, the slow crumbling of U.S. imperial hegemony that has existed since World War II, since the end of World War II, when Britain and France went into decline, and the U.S. replaced them as the regional power. We now see it's not going to disappear overnight, and the U.S. will fight back. We've seen in Egypt how the United States did all it could to try and keep the Mubarak regime in power, and is now doing all it can to support other repressive Arab regimes and to forestall a change in those countries. So this is it's not going to be a pushover, but its power, its hegemony, is under a challenge that it has never been under before. And it's under a challenge from the people themselves. This is crucial. The second era that is coming to an end, focusing on Palestine, is the Oslo era. The era that began with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993, and where the basic deal under the guise of the so-called peace process was that Israel would maintain and continue its occupation and colonization, but it would subcontract the occupation duties, the task of repressing the Palestinian people, to a Palestinian subcontractor, the so-called Palestinian Authority. And the story that would be told is this is all in preparation for a Palestinian state. Now people can see that the billions in aid that were invested in the West Bank did not go to building a future Palestinian state. They have gone to building, under the Palestinian Authority, exactly the kind of repressive police state, only this in this case it's not even a state, a police pseudo-state of exactly the kind that people are rising up against in Tunisia and Egypt. And look at the panic. Look at the panic in Israel. A story from Haaretz. They're noticing what's going on. They're scared to death. They were devastated, the Israeli military and political establishment, at the loss of Mubarak. And a piece appears in Haaretz yesterday called IDF is preparing for mass civil uprising in West Bank. And it says the following. I'll just read a few relevant parts. The Central Command and the Judea and Samaria Division of the Israel Defense Forces have been closely monitoring the recent events in the Arab states and updating their operational plans for dealing with a potential popular nonviolent uprising. Of course, there is already a potential, there is already a popular nonviolent uprising in many places in the West Bank and Gaza, which Israel deals with by shooting and tear gassing people. But they're talking about something even bigger. And they say, senior officers now serving or who once served in the West Bank say they have long felt there is no way to effectively contend with a widespread nonviolent civil uprising. There is nothing for it if something like what happened in Tunisia happens here. In other words, you have the Israelis themselves acknowledging that they are powerless against people power. But here, even more important, how does Israel keep control now? In the past 2 years, the security coordination between the IDF, the Israeli army, and the security agencies of the Palestinian Authority have become an important component in defense strategy throughout the West Bank. So just as the United States relied on Mubarak as a regional client, Israel relies on the Palestinian Authority as a local client. That said, the IDF recognizes that in the event of a popular uprising, it will not be able to count on the PA forces to repress Palestinians, and is searching for other channels within the local civilian leadership. Translation: the collaborators we currently have cannot be relied on. We need to find other collaborators. That is a dead end. Israel has really got nowhere left to go. So I think I will end now by saying that I can't tell you what's going to happen. I don't think there's a formula, but I think that the future is open, that we can win. And winning means bringing an end to apartheid, an end to colonial rule, an end to the gross violations of human rights, and creating a future that gives everybody, Palestinians and Israelis, a decent life, that gives restitution and justice to victims, that brings an end to the exile of Palestinian refugees, that gives Israelis for the first time the possibility of living a normal life, not as settlers and colonizers and oppressors, but as normalized citizens in a state which belongs to all who live in it. That, I think, is within our reach, and that's what we have to work for. Thank you.